Well, it's a great pleasure to be here today. I'm grateful for and honored by the invitation to participate in this conference. The topic is a very important one, a topic, that's to say, of redeeming reason. Though, as will become apparent from my remarks, I'm not sure that the central problem facing Christian scholars and students is lack of confidence in reason. That certainly, as I shall argue, is not the problem in the university at large. Reason, I think, may not need to be redeemed so much as properly disciplined. And that is, in some ways, a more difficult task. But in any case, my title, given to me by the organizers of this conference, is Being a Roman Catholic Scholar in a Secular University Today. And in order properly to address that topic, I'll begin with some diagnostic remarks on the nature and condition of the contemporary secular university and the place of reason in that university. And we'll move from there to some more theoretical remarks about what Christians should expect from the use of reason and argument in secular universities. All of this is informed by my experience, which, as you just heard, has been mostly in non-Christian institutions of higher education. I taught for 10 years in this university, which is a private and now secular university, though it, in fact, has Baptist roots, though it's rather hard to tell that now. And for the last 5 years, I've been teaching at the University of Illinois, which is a large state university here in the Midwest. For a few years before that, I taught at the University of Notre Dame, which, of course, is a Catholic university in Indiana, which you heard something about this morning as well. So, with those preliminaries in mind, and under the compassionate gaze of the highly literate angels who are looking down upon us, let's turn to our work. You know, it's odd, very odd, to think about angels as needing to read books. I don't know what your own angelology is, but a good theory of angels means they don't need to read. However, there they are, reading. However. So, I'll begin by stating two claims, each of which I hope will be sufficiently controversial that it might provide some fuel for discussion of a useful and productive kind for the topic of our considerations here today. I'll provide some support for each claim, but my intention is not to establish these claims beyond argument. I want principally to stimulate discussion by them. And to achieve that goal, I can just as well be wrong as right. But before I get to those two claims, let me offer you some a definition and a couple of caveats. So the definition. When I speak of the university, I shall mean the American secular university. The four-year land-grant state universities, of which the University of Illinois, which I teach, is one, that took shape in the middle of the 19th century, provide one paradigm for this. And the American research universities, Johns Hopkins, Stanford, and the one we're now in, Chicago, founded toward the end of the 19th century on the German model, provide another. Matters would become more complicated were I to discuss as well the four-year liberal arts college, the many religiously affiliated universities and colleges, and certainly the systems of higher education in other countries and other continents. But although complexity would be introduced by discussing all those, I do not think that the main lines of the picture I shall draw would need very much alteration. The American secular university is now the archetype, both in this country and worldwide. All institutions of higher education revolve around it, either by trying to become it or by actively resisting it. In either case, they're revolving around it. So in both of those cases, the archetypal significance of the American secular university is acknowledged. And those institutions that attempt resistance are increasingly marginalized by the difficulty they find in attracting the university's lifeblood, which is research dollars from government, foundations, and individuals. So that's what I mean by the university. A caveat. I shall speak often of Christian intellectual work, Christians in the university, and so on. Much of what I say, I hope, is applicable also to Jews, Muslims, and some others, but I shan't make such applications. Not for lack of interest in them, so much as for lack of time and because of some ethical concerns about saying what Jews, Muslims, and others ought to do and think. That's up to them, not up to me. I can do that, though, correctably and fallibly, of course, for Christians, because I speak as one. If you're not a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim and prefer to think about and engage in your intellectual work under some other rubric, then I crave your indulgence. You can observe what I have to say as the doings of an alien, and if you spend much time in universities, that should be a familiar enough experience. I should also say that although I'll generally use the word Christian, it may be that a good part of what I say has specifically Catholic flavor to it, and that may be a matter for discussion at the end. An additional caveat, I will have to skate quickly over some complicated historical and conceptual matters, sometimes so quickly as to be misleading. I can only plead constraints of time in extenuation, but I also plead the necessity of looking at the big picture without getting lost in particularities. So with those caveats in mind and with a definition in mind, I proceed to the two claims I want to start with. The first claim I want to lay before you is that the secular university at the beginning of the third millennium in the United States is constitutively and essentially an agonistic place, which is to say, a place of intellectual struggle. And that those who work in universities, faculty and administrators, are increasingly aware that this is so, and increasingly happy to say so to one another and in public. My second claim is that the fact of the university's self-consciously agonistic nature is a good thing for those who want to think, write, and teach within the university as Christians, and that coming to see this should affect how Christians in the university think about and undertake their own intellectual work. So much in brief for the two claims. Now for some elaboration and defense of them. To say that the university is essentially, constitutively, and now often explicitly an agonistic place, a place of intellectual struggle, is to say to begin with that it has no intellectual center, no substantive core of agreement about anything that matters with respect to the intellectual life, and that everything, or almost everything, can be and is argued about. The faculty of the university is, as William Rainey Harper is said to have said, united only by the common possession of a central heating plant. And now we might add, he was writing 60 years ago, now we might add by the common use of a web of fiber optic cables. I take it that this claim is almost self-evidently true. There may well be disagreement among us about how we ought to respond to it. We might beat our breasts and wish it were not so. We might look back to a golden age, 1950, 1920, 1890, before Plato, I don't know. A golden age when it was not true, when, for example, all faculty in the humanities, but even to call it that, is already to commit ourselves to a particular deeply Germanic view of what education in history, philosophy, and literature is all about. But we might imagine a time when all faculty in the humanities shared a set of convictions about what ought to be studied, how it ought to be studied, and with what end in view. We might try to found institutions in which the fragmentation and agonistic nature of the university is denied or obscured. Or we might try to reshape our own institutions away from this situation and toward a more unified one. Or we might, as for the most part I do, welcome the situation and try to turn it to our own ends, which in my case and in many of yours are Christian ends. But whatever our response to the university's lack of an intellectual core, we will be acknowledging it as a fact. It is not, I think, effectively deniable as such. When an institution is deeply plural in the sense I've just mentioned, which is to say, when it provides offices and salaries to a range of people who share almost no common understanding of what the institution is for and how its resources should be used, it stands in some danger of ceasing to exist. Practical decisions become difficult. Questions such as, who should be hired? To do what? With what proportion of the institution's resources, and who is to make decisions about such matters, become increasingly pressing, and increasingly thorny. There are, I think, two fundamental responses to these practical problems that spring from the fragmented nature of the university. The first family of responses I'll call silent fragmentation. Deeply plural institutions that follow this route subdivide themselves into ever smaller quasi-independent units. Units that can, theoretically, gather people who do share some convictions about the relevant topics and who will be able, therefore, to make some practical decisions when these have to be made. Universities tend to call these units departments. Harvard, it's a university somewhere in the East, I think, Harvard has a motto that nicely summarizes this approach: every tub on its own bottom. The motto was developed to explain the financial structure of that university and now of many others, a structure according to which every unit of the university had to manage its own budget independently of the others. But it applies nicely to the departmentally structured acknowledgement of intellectual fragmentation as well. When the sociology department, the law school, and the English department, just to take some examples, are all set firmly on their own bottoms, they can make their own practical decisions, and they will, it is hoped, not be so internally riven that they begin to replicate within themselves the fragmentation already evident in the wider university. Practitioners of silent fragmentation typically do not say that the departmental structures of the university are a response to fragmentation, neither do they encourage or provide the institutional structures for explicit engagement of the intellectual differences that produced the fragmentation in the first place. Quite the opposite, in fact. This silent fragmentation response is intertwined with the development of the academic disciplines, which itself has a history just about as long as the kinds of universities that I'm here discussing. The department provides an institutional home for the practitioners of the discipline, English, history, philosophy, and so on, within a particular university. Each discipline is then in turn linked to a national and an international disciplinary guild, and then within each university, the disciplinary departments can get on with what they do without having to justify or explain it to those who do something different. Indeed, no one even expects that such justification or explanation is possible, because the technicalities and particular training required by each discipline make cross-disciplinary conversation almost impossible and almost always annoying. The departmental discipline-based university, remnants of which are all around us, then, is deeply and irreducibly plural, but it is not agonistic. There is no struggle, because each discipline is a self-enclosed universe, and struggle with those who do something different is neither required nor rewarded. On this model, therefore, silence rules and fragmentation endures without much friction, just so long as the university has sufficient reason of some other sort, state funding, large endowments, and so on, to continue in being. And just so long as the disciplines and departments remain sufficiently unified that they can continue to make the decisions they need to make. If all this is so, there needs to be neither agreement nor argument about the nature, goals, and aims of the intellectual life, nor even about whether there is any such thing. And those of you who've spent any time on interdisciplinary tenure committees or interdisciplinary curricular committees in large state universities will know that discussions immediately devolve to the procedural and avoid the substantive. They must. There is no way to engage the substantive question, so one can only discuss matters of procedure, which of course we do at great length and sometimes with great virtuosity. But there is also another possible response to deep pluralism within the university. This response, let's call it vociferous fragmentation, openly acknowledges the lack of agreement and common vocabulary among the university's faculty, celebrates it under the label of diversity, and encourages public engagement among the opposing groups. This response is becoming increasingly common, I believe, and there are several reasons for that. The first is that the small-scale unity provided by the disciplines has been breaking down for a generation. And so, the status quo of silent fragmentation is harder to sustain. When, for example, the English department cannot break its deadlock over hiring because the new historicists and the deconstructionists can't agree, or when the history department can't decide whether they need somebody in cultural studies or a paleographer, then there's a danger that the department will suffer the fate of the university. A smart response to this, and I think roughly speaking the right one, is to acknowledge the disagreements, make them public and explicit, and provide institutional structures that will permit or require active engagement among opposed groups. Another reason for an increase in vociferously rather than silently fragmented institutions is that in most universities, and certainly those of which I've had the pleasure of teaching, there has been, over the past two or three decades, an interesting increase in the institutional presence of what are best thought of as tradition-specific stances toward the intellectual life. These include things like gender studies, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender studies, disability studies, African-American studies, and now, more recently, whiteness studies and diversity studies. Perhaps this last is best thought of as a meta-stance, right? Because it's a stance toward a fact about the university which is itself already a stance, right? Now, these tradition-specific stances toward the intellectual life are not disciplines, They are not to be found within the 19th century German research university, and there is no effective history of departments or international academic guilds devoted to them. It is true that the remnants of the guild-based departmental system attempts to co-opt them, and so sometimes we find departments made out of these tradition-specific stances toward the intellectual life. But it's also often the case that these newcomers resist departmentalization, judging that they can best fulfill their mission as free-floating programs capable of planting sleepers and spies in the fossilized or imploding departments. But this is a complex and still relatively new situation, too young yet for full-blown analysis. A close study of the minutes of discussions at a range of universities about such matters as whether the program in transgender studies should become a department might provide a good dissertation topic for someone interested in institutional history. That's not really a joke either, I think it actually would, and quite revealing for Christians for reasons I'll get to in a moment. The tradition-specific stances toward the intellectual life that I've mentioned typically have a couple of other interesting properties that implicate them causally with the story I've been telling about the growth of vociferous fragmentation in the university. One is that they are universalistic. They typically present a stance meant to be relevant to all intellectual work upon whatever topic, and as a result are not happy with the departmental ghetto. Consider, for example, the gender variable. Some advocates of gender studies will say that attention to gender is of essential importance to all intellectual work, and that such work is irresponsible and otherwise flawed precisely to the extent that it ignores this variable. Silence is not likely for somebody who thinks like this. Active engagement is much more likely, and this explains the evangelistic intent of some such programs and their advocates. They don't want simply to be permitted to exist. No, they want to convince all others of the rightness and goodness of their stance, and to sow its seeds broadside, hoping for fruitful growth in every department. Such stances are, then, often both universalist and evangelical. This should make Christians pay attention, and I'll return to the point in a moment. A vociferously fragmented university, an agonistic university, is then one in which the old departmental structure is falling into disarray, in which the universalistic and evangelical tradition-specific stances toward the intellectual life assume an increasing prominence, and in which, as a result, everyone's nose is rubbed, whether they like it or not, in the fact that there is no effectively shared commitment about the nature, purposes, or procedures of the intellectual life. The agon, the struggle, will become a normal fact of life in such a university. The university will survive to precisely the extent that argument between and among a broad array of such tradition-specific stances is made institutionally possible and is eagerly engaged in. There are some signs that this is the direction in which the secular university, including the one at which I teach, the University of Illinois, is moving. These signs are good, good especially for Christians, I think, and I wish there were more of them. My second claim, you'll recall, you may recall, is that the fact of the university's self-consciously agonistic nature is a good thing for those who want to think, write, and teach within the university as Christians, and that coming to see this should affect how Christians in the university think about and undertake their intellectual work. But about this, I think it can be relatively brief. Christianity is, precisely, one of the tradition-specific stances toward the intellectual life that I've mentioned. It is also, and obviously, like its rivals in thinking that it would be a good thing if everyone could come to see its own rightness, and that all intellectual life that proceeds in ignorance of or opposition to what Christianity teaches is, to just that extent, imperfect. Those who think, read, write, and teach from within a specifically Christian set of commitments cannot flourish within a silently fragmented, departmentally ordered university. Every tub is never, for the Christian, on its own bottom. All float instead in the sea of God's mercy and wisdom, and intellectual life proceeds more fully and perfectly when this is realized and publicly acknowledged. The telos, the goal, and the starting point of all intellectual work done by Christians is adoration of the God whose gifts made it possible in the first place, and to whose greater glory it is done. The idea that the intellectual disciplines are self-generated and self-sustaining is not one that a Christian can accept. And since a silently fragmented university is one that implies such acceptance, it is not one in which Christians doing intellectual work can flourish. The vociferously fragmented and agonistic university, in contrast, is just what Christians should expect in a fallen world, a world where not everyone is explicitly related to the God of Abraham, and where many deny the possibility or desirability of any such relation. What Christians with an intellectual vocation should expect and seek in such a world, and it's the actual world, the one that we live in, is the chance to speak as who they are, to advert to the sources of authority that in fact they recognize, and to argue with those who disagree. The agonistic university provides exactly this. In such a university, the Christian voice is one alongside many others, but it does not have to hide its light under a bushel, to censor itself lest it sound too Christian. And both of these are typically necessary in a silently fragmented university. Christians should then applaud the gradual evolution of the agonistic university and should take a full part in it. It is interesting then that many Christians in the academy do not. Many resist the agonistic university and the provision of institutional space and resources to intellectual stances that are fundamentally opposed to that of Christianity. They do so most often not in the name of Christianity. After all, where would the argument that there shouldn't be a gay and lesbian studies program because its commitments are opposed to Christianity get you in the secular university? No, such arguments proceed rather, typically, in the name of academic tradition or academic excellence or the values of the West or the importance of religion or some similar useless abstraction. But this is a dangerous argument for Christians. If it's accepted, it would exclude from the secular university those of us who would wish to think, speak, teach, and write explicitly as Christians. For its underlying assumption is that it is possible to have a non-fragmented university whose faculty share an understanding of the nature, goal, and methods of the intellectual life that is concordant with and properly preparatory for a Christian understanding of these matters without itself being Christian. But this is not possible. I'll offer you some theoretical reasons why it's not in a moment. But this is not possible, not anyway, in our current situation with its particular history. Divisions on these matters go very deep as it is possible to imagine. The result is that when Christians attempt to advocate quasi-Christian positions without doing so on the basis of explicitly Christian conviction, they fail, and they do so in a way that misses an opportunity. The deep question here is, what would a Christian university look like, and should Christians want the secular university to be or to approximate one? My own tentative view on this difficult matter is that Christians should think about the possibility and desirability of a Christian university in just the same way that we do or should think about the possibility and desirability of a Christian society. Our attitude to these things falls under the theological virtue of hope, and it is properly and fully eschatological. We do not expect to see either a fully Christian university or a fully Christian society before the end of all things. And yet, we must act in the service of bringing precisely such institutions into being, knowing that we will fail in doing so. What might this mean in the case of the secular university? It means, at least, offering explicitly Christian intellectual work, teaching and writing, to the university. It means advocating and working for the greater prominence of such work in the university, but doing so always with the knowledge that arguments and efforts aimed at this end will very likely fail, and that the reason why they will fail is precisely the reason that the world is not yet converted and not finally redeemed. Realizing that the university is irretrievably fragmented and that it is becoming increasingly agonistic should then have an effect upon how Christians, and not only Christians, of course, in the academy, think about and do their work. It should encourage them to be explicit about the deliverances of their tradition and argumentatively to engage those who speak from different traditions. That is the agon, the struggle. But it should also encourage them to be suspicious of and to speak against the ambitions of those who would defend the older, silently fragmented, departmental disciplinary Echt Deutsch Wissenschaftliche, that means thoroughly German scientific, sounds much better in German, doesn't it? Thoroughly German scientific model of the university. That should all be resisted. There are some interesting implications here for a Christian understanding of the uses of reason in the fragmented agonistic university I've been depicting. The problem in such a university is not that reason is undervalued. Neither is it, in my view, that relativism runs riot. Sophomoric relativism is, in my now, God help me, 22 years of teaching. Sophomoric relativism is, in my experience, largely confined precisely to sophomores, no surprise there. My colleagues at the University of Illinois, here at the University of Chicago, have been and are, for the most part, very much not relativists with respect to the capacities of reason. They are instead very intelligent, thoughtful people, deeply committed to the search for truth and to the use of reason as part of that search. They are, nonetheless, from my point of view and from that of most Christians, often wrong and sometimes profoundly so. How can this be? And here's where we need some theoretical considerations about what reason is and what it can do in order to understand how that can be. But you must buy the assumption, and I hope you do, that your colleagues, your fellow students in the university who are not Christians, are not despisers of reason, typically, and very often they're not dumber than you are either. Very often they're much smarter than you are. What's the problem then? We need to address that. Reason's optimists, Christian and otherwise, are puzzled by the fact I've just mentioned, the fact of deep, enduring disagreement about what really matters on the part of thoughtful and intelligent people. Reason's optimists are likely to be puzzled, among other things, by the fact that rational argument is not usually persuasive. They are looking for the kind of argument that will immediately convince all who come across it. And since all arguments also deploy judgments, they will typically also expect the judgments deployed in the ideal argument to seem luminously correct to all who understand them. There is, reason's optimists may think, something about all human beings, their rationality perhaps, that ought to make non-fallacious and misapprehension-free arguments immediately convincing to us all. But when faced with the starkly obvious fact that there are few judgments whose luminosity is of the required intensity, and even fewer arguments whose validity is as obvious as it ought to be, and certainly none of either about anything remotely interesting, reason's optimists, faced with that unfortunate set of circumstances, usually add a list of qualifications. I don't mean, an optimist will say, that the judgments I'm making and the arguments I'm offering will or ought to be expected to convince everyone. No, I expect them to convince only adult, properly equipped, well-intentioned, well-educated, and attentive people. But then, the optimist's expectations have been severely constrained, for the set of people who meet these qualifications is vastly smaller than the set of all human beings. Its members may not extend much beyond the optimist's family and friends, if even that far. Contemporary Christians, especially those who like to talk about natural law, and this is a Catholic thing, so Protestants may not talk about it so much, so bear with me. Contemporary Christians, especially those who like to talk about natural law in an epistemic as well as an ontological sense, often act as if they are among reason's optimists. Arguments are offered in the public sphere, for example, about such highly theoretical matters as the legality and desirability of abortion or of same-sex marriage or the propriety of international debt forgiveness and so on, with the apparent hope that the previously unconvinced will hear these arguments and be swayed by the luminosity of the judgments deployed in them and the irresistibly persuasive power of the arguments in which the judgments are arrayed. And, in an attempt to make this result more likely, so it seems often to be thought, explicitly Christian talk is occluded, hidden, obscured in such arguments, even when they are offered by Christians. Such occlusion is thought desirable, usually, because it's expected that the presence of explicitly Christian judgment in an argument will make the persuasion of a non-Christian interlocutor less likely than it would be were such judgments, in fact, there on the very surface of the discourse. This is the immediate context that makes addressing the question of how theoretical reasoning goes wrong important. The adoption of the kind of rationalist optimism just mentioned encourages Christians to speak a language from which explicitly Christian talk has been expunged, and to do so with the vain hope of increasing agreement about theoretical matters. These are not merely errors, in my view. They are errors demeaning to the intellectual tradition they claim to represent, errors that lead to a misrepresentation of that tradition in public argument, and errors that can be corrected by the adoption of a just and moderate pessimism about the capacities of theoretical reason, a pessimism required by a proper theoretical account of reasoning and why it goes wrong. I suspect, though I shall not here attempt to show, that the optimism about the capacities of reason in matters theoretical, all too evident among some contemporary users of natural law theory, and there are Protestant analogues here, stems from a confusion of the claim that there is natural law with the claim that the content of that law is knowable to all. These are quite separate claims. It's perfectly possible to affirm the former without the latter, and the tendency to think that if you want one, you must have the other ought to be resisted. I suspect, too, that a close look at the history of debate among Catholic Christians and at magisterial teaching on this matter in the last 3 centuries or so about the knowability of the natural law would show that the tendency to confuse those claims is a product of the polemical demands of the Counter-Reformation first and of the Enlightenment second. If you have to argue first with Luther and then with Spinoza and Locke, it is all too possible that unnuanced affirmations of the duplex ordo cognitionis, that's Latin for the twofold order of knowing, meaning natural reason on the one hand and revelation or supernatural reason on the other, right? Duplex ordo cognitionis is very much a buzzword in Catholic circles. In my view, it would be better left behind, but there you go. But this is no longer our polemical situation. And so perhaps a fully Christian and properly nuanced moderate pessimism about theoretical reason can now be recovered. It is just such a moderate pessimism that I should like to state and advocate in terms of our situation in the kinds of universities I sketched in the first part of this talk. Moderate pessimists about reason, then, by contrast with optimists, have the advantage of thinking it quite normal that valid arguments with true premises in the theoretical realm do not persuade those who do not already assent to their conclusions. Perhaps more precisely, they expect that the persuasiveness of arguments is closely linked to the luminosity of their premises' truth and of their own validity. They will also, and reasonably, so far as I can see, doubt that many arguments have premises or validity high on the scale of luminosity, and that certainly none in the theoretical sphere do. It remains now to ask why this is so. Why, that is, do arguments in the theoretical sphere so rarely persuade? Why do they rarely carry conviction? Why do they rarely persuade those who do not already, and on other grounds, assent to their conclusions? There are, I suggest, 2 fundamental causes for the typical failure of a valid theoretical argument with true premises to persuade those who are faced with it. Maybe it would be helpful to have in our minds an example of a valid theoretical argument with true premises. Some of you will know St. Anselm's ontological argument, whose conclusion is that God necessarily exists. I commend you to the 3rd and 4th chapters of Anselm's Proslogion for the classic statement of this argument. In my judgment, the argument is valid, and it has true premises, from which it follows that the conclusion is true. But I also think it quite reasonable not to think so, either because you can't understand the argument, because it's too difficult, or because you have philosophical convictions drawn from quite other spheres of argument that lead you to doubt some of Anselm's convictions in this argument. And to sort those out would require redoing your entire metaphysic. You're not going to do that. Almost nobody does that. So if the argument is valid with true premises, as I take it to be, it does not follow from it bearing those properties that it should be convincing to all. And indeed, as a matter of fact, it's not convincing to all. So at least the position I'm advocating has the great virtue of being in accord with what empirical study shows, which is that if you offer this argument to any randomly selected group of people and spend an hour with each of them convincing them, trying to show them what it means, a very small proportion of them will be convinced by it, which has nothing at all to do with whether it's a good argument. Absolutely nothing. Right? So keep that in mind as an example. There are, I suggest, 2 fundamental causes for the typical failure of a valid theoretical argument with true premises to persuade those who are faced with it. The first is inadequate catechesis, the second is disordered love, and neither can be cured by argument. If then somebody who is not convinced, not persuaded, by the offer of a valid theoretical argument, it won't do simply to offer them more arguments. You need something else. So let's take these 2 factors that influence the reasons why people don't accept valid arguments when they're offered in turn and say a few words about each of them. The first one, remember, is inadequate catechesis. The second one is disordered love. Catechesis, that's a nice word. It actually comes from a Greek verb meaning to echo, which is a nice thing to bear in mind, but we'll save discussion of that perhaps. Catechesis may be understood narrowly as instruction in revealed truth as found in Scripture and in the tradition of the Church. This is certainly part of its meaning. The catechist, taking her stand upon 1 Timothy 6:20, understands herself as having been entrusted with a depositum, a paratheke in Greek, that she must hand on by teaching it to others. In this sense, catechesis' primary function is to hand on information. But the act of catechizing may and should also be understood to include the transmitting of skills, among them the skills of reading and responding to Scripture, skills not derivable from Scripture alone, I would argue, and skills of worship. Catechesis, to use the English philosopher Gilbert Ryle's terms, transmits not only knowing that information, but also know-how, the capacity to engage in a form of activity, what Wittgenstein would call knowing how to go on. It is then a species of apprenticeship, as well as a course of instruction. And one of the ways in which the Church recognizes this is to include mystagogy as an element intrinsic and proper to catechesis. We can talk more about that if you want afterwards. Now, a general truth. Inadequate or improper catechesis is among the principal causes of inability to recognize a true judgment as true, a false judgment as false, a valid argument as valid, and an invalid argument as invalid. If, when faced with a judgment or an argument, you lack access to the relevant information or skills essential to its or their assessment, you will typically be unable to come to any conclusion about the judgment's truth or the argument's validity. And if you think you can come to conclusions, they'll almost certainly be wrong. I, for example, am in that situation with respect to probability theory. Almost all the claims that probability theorists tell me are true seem to me not to be. But I'm prepared to acknowledge, because I don't understand probability theory very well, that they know better than I do. But that doesn't alter the fact that when faced with the central claims of probability theory, they seem to me loony. But that's a problem about me, not about the claims of probability theory. The same will be true about arguments for the existence of God and so forth and so on. Catechesis is required. If I sat down for 5 years with a good probability theorist, maybe, though I doubt it, it would get better. That would be a species of catechesis in probability theory. Lack of proper catechesis is especially problematic with respect to theoretical questions. Obviously, it matters less in practical or sheerly technical matters. If, for example, we want to argue with someone about how many chairs there are in the room, we can easily do so usually and come to something like agreement. But if we want to argue about the proper ontology to deploy in giving an account of what a chair is, we cannot easily do so, and we are unlikely to come to agreement. So that's the first general truth, that inadequate catechesis is a central cause for the inability to recognize true judgments as true, valid arguments as valid, and so on. And now for a second general truth, drawn from these remarks about the significance of adequate catechesis. It is that the nature and extent of the catechetically produced convictions that inform a particular judgment about a matter of theory, about, say, the nature of human beings and their proper ends, or about the nature of knowledge and the methods by which it ought to be constituted, ought not to be systematically and deliberately obscured in argument for the truth of that judgment. The extent to which this is done is precisely the extent to which argument will fail, and the tradition in the service of which argument is offered will be brought into disrepute, which is to say that when you're arguing with somebody about something, you need first to figure out what catechesis they've had. Second, if it turns out to be inadequate, stop arguing. Third, if it seems relatively adequate, make quite clear to your interlocutor what catechesis is presupposed by what you're telling them. Otherwise, things just don't work. A third and final general truth based upon these remarks about catechesis is the decisions about what to say to a particular interlocutor or group of interlocutors ought always to be made with an eye upon the kind of catechesis they appear already to have had. This too is obvious, but one aspect of our current situation is the tendency to ignore it and to adopt a single mode of argumentative engagement, no matter the interlocutor. In many cases, awareness of the catechetical formation of the interlocutor will make argument of any sort entirely inappropriate. I would not, for example, offer to a five-year-old the kind of argument about whether God's existence is self-evident that Thomas Aquinas offers in Summa Theologiae 1a2. But neither would I offer those arguments to a follower of Michel Foucault or a Sakya Buddhist, but for different reasons. The five-year-old just hasn't got any kind of intellectual equipment to speak of, and certainly not equipment that's any good for arguments about necessity and probability. But the follower of Foucault and the Sakya Buddhist have very thorough catechesis, but of a totally different kind that simply doesn't prepare them to enter into that discourse at all, but gives them another set of discourse that they want to argue about. The mistake to worry about here, then, is to read the natural law tradition to mean that identical argumentative strategies ought to be adopted, no matter what the catechetical preparation of the audience, or worse, to think that some audience may have had no catechetical preparation at all. All audiences over about age 7 are already thoroughly catechized one way or another. Inadequate or improper catechesis is then an important cause of inability to assess properly the truth of a judgment or the validity of an argument. It goes far to explain why arguments in matters of theory are so rarely persuasive. That catechetical preparation is important in developing the capacity for such assessment is supportive of the thesis, for which there are other grounds, that the principal purpose of argument in such matters is not to persuade, but rather to provide discursive meditation upon what is independently known to be the case. This has an obvious application to life in an agonistic university. Argument is constitutive of agonistic universities and ought with zeal to be engaged in, but don't expect it to do much for you. It won't convince. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be engaged in, but it should be engaged in with the right expectations. But catechetical inadequacy is not the only cause for reasoning's failure to persuade or to be comprehensible in interesting theoretical matters. The second reason, already mentioned, is disordered love. Disordered love, that is, on the part of those being argued with. This is language borrowed from St. Augustine, but it is also scriptural and forms part of the very fabric of the Christian tradition. The fundamental idea behind this language of disordered love is that each of us has loves, that's to say, appetites that we direct toward things which we find valuable, attractive, interesting, important, and that these loves can be profoundly disordered or well ordered. If disordered, then loves that ought to be directed toward God and the beauties of God's creation are instead directed to other things which are idols or are treated as such. Augustine thinks, quite rightly in my view, that all of us have more or less disordered loves. It's simply a question of degree. So, drawing upon Augustine, I'll say that theoretical reasoning goes wrong, not in a technical fashion, often, but rather because of disordered love on the part of those engaging in it or being faced by it. Our capacity for accurate reasoning, in the theoretical sphere at least, is therefore indexed closely to the order of our loves. Offering argument to those in error will therefore usually be an attempt to correct an affective and cognitive disorder, disordered love that is, with a technical device, the device of argument. But the device will have no purchase. What those in cognitive error then need is encouragement to piety rather than argument. Augustine likes to quote a text from the book of Job, Ecce pietas est sapientia. Look, piety is wisdom. Now, unfortunately, that text from the book of Job only exists in the Latin version of the Old Testament that he read. So if you go and look up Job 8:28, I think it is, in your Bible, it won't be there. Such is life. There's a long, complex story about that that has to do with the authoritative weight of the Septuagint, which we could also discuss, but I'll leave that aside for now. So by piety, I don't mean simply the observance of pious practices, though I certainly mean to include that. I mean piety as productive of wisdom. There's a very important connection there in the thought of the church fathers. So, to draw these threads together, I suggest that catechetical inadequacy and disordered love each suffice for the occurrence of certain kinds of error in theoretical reason, most especially for inability to recognize a true judgment as true and a valid argument as valid, but neither is necessary. This means that catechetical inadequacy of various kinds may occur without disordered love, and that deeply disordered love may go hand in hand with good catechesis. A properly nuanced and anti-donatist view of the church suggests that this ought to be right. That's to say, a view of the church which says that it is comprised both of those who are destined for damnation and those who are not, those whose loves are well ordered and those whose loves are profoundly disordered. Diagnosis of the nature and extent of the presence of both in a particular interlocutor then will be required if productive argument is to be had. But whatever is the case about the relative weight of each of these factors in predisposing people to err in the use of theoretical reason, they together account for the vast majority of cases of such error. If I'm faced with a valid argument whose premises are true and I do not recognize it as such, the cure for this condition will almost never be found in the offer of another argument. I will need either appropriate catechesis or increase of piety, and I'm unlikely to be persuaded to either by argument. It follows from this position, I think, that the position here argued about how reasoning goes wrong will, if correct, be persuasive only to those rightly catechized. It does not, as a position, avoid its own strictures, and it can meet its own desiderata. What that means, to put rather more bluntly, is if you didn't find convincing all that I just said, that means that your loves are disordered and or you've been badly catechized. That's actually not a joke. There's a very serious point there, but we'll... Now, to return to the university, that what we've just done is a theoretical excursus. To return to the university, then, and the proper uses of reason within it by Christians. In the secular university, we occupy and advocate theoretical positions that we take to be true. We Christians, I mean. We find ourselves cheek by jowl with others who are equally committed to the search for truth and the use of argument, but who, because of inadequate catechesis and disordered love, are simply confused and wrong. In this situation, we should engage in the agon, the intellectual struggle, with zeal and gusto, the kind of zeal we have for the Lord's house, to quote Psalm, whatever it is, 69, I think. But we should do so with just the same modest hope with which we seek social justice, which is to say, with a certain knowledge that it is not we who act, but Christ who acts in us, and that the hope of success is to be given over to him rather than hugged to ourselves. Let me conclude then by saying a few things briefly about the two initiatives that I've been involved in within the university setting, both of which I take in my own mind, not necessarily in the minds of those engaged with them, not in the minds of all of those engaged with them anyway. These initiatives I take to try to exemplify the position I've just been arguing. The first initiative is a very small undergraduate program in Catholic studies, which I began to work on in the year 2000 at the University of Illinois here in Chicago, a large state university. I was hired to do that by a secular university because the university has interest, well, because it received money. Universities always respond well to money. But in addition to that, the university judged that it had interests in developing tradition-specific programs of the kind I earlier talked about. So Catholic studies, Jewish studies, Islamic studies, whiteness studies, gay, lesbian studies, it's all the same. You know, they're all supported because they're good, right? So my idea about that program is twofold. First of all, that it ought to provide to undergraduates, it teaches only undergraduates, it ought to provide good, thorough, intellectually stimulating exposure to the Christian intellectual tradition. That's its central purpose. It does that in the full knowledge that those same undergraduates are taking at the same time as they're taking those courses, other courses in other units of the university that stand in complete contradiction in many important ways to what they are hearing from the Catholic intellectual tradition. That's not a problem. That's a fact. And it's an interesting fact. So part of what I try to do in teaching undergraduates is to get them to thematize and theorize that very fact, the fact of profound disagreement in the institution that they find themselves in. And there are deep resources within the Christian tradition for that. So that part of it is an attempt to provide nuanced catechesis to students. Now, I should add that not all the students I get are Catholic and not all of them are Christian. That doesn't mean, though, that I treat them differently in this respect. They get the same intellectual material. On the faculty side of things, my job at the University of Illinois, as I understand it, is to engage my colleagues as fully and richly as I can on matters of joint interest. Sometimes this leads to irreducible disagreement. Sometimes, though rarely, to difficult personal relationships. But often it leads to, I think, mutually fruitful situations. I'll mention just one example. The University of Illinois, like a number of others in the country, has begun a quite large program in disability studies, which is devoted partly to the medical aspects of physical and mental disability, but also to the philosophical and conceptual aspects of that, of thinking about what we mean when we talk about health and the nature of the human and what it means not to have all the capacities that a human being might have, to have other ones, and so on. There's a hugely rich and interesting set of interfaces and connections between the Catholic tradition on these questions and the resources that are being brought to bear by my colleagues, almost all of whom are not Christian, in the disability studies program. That's interesting. It's fruitful. That doesn't mean they agree with me or I with them, but it means I've learned a lot from them and they may have learned something from me. That's up to them to say, of course. So that's one initiative that doesn't try to remake the university into the image of the church, but does take seriously the opportunity for intellectual engagement and catechesis in the broad sense. The other initiative is the foundation of a freestanding or independent institute here in Hyde Park called the Lumen Christi Institute, which was founded in 1997 by myself and some other people when I was still on the faculty of this university. Its principal purpose is to provide within a university setting, usually this university, but not always, sometimes other universities in the Chicago area, to provide within a university setting high-level intellectual events, either one-off events or continuing series of events, some for undergraduates, some for graduate students, some for faculty, some a mix of all three, under the understanding that what we're trying to do is simply to present, to offer the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition from which we grow and that nourishes us. We do not expect, fortunately, because it rarely happens, we do not expect conversion, we do not expect agreement, we do expect to be taken seriously intellectually. And the way to do that is to have really interesting things to say and really good arguments and to be smart, that helps too. All of those things together mean that a particular intellectual tradition, in this case the Catholic one, can begin to enter more fully into the fabric of an institution like the University of Chicago. We've met with partial success, I would say, and many failures, but that too is the nature of the enterprise we undertake. Good, thank you very much. Can we do some questions? Yeah.
Given what you say, would we be better off, rather than engaging in argument, just devoting our time to trying to encourage increased piety? And part two, given, regardless of the answer to the first question, presumably we ought to be encouraging increased piety, at least a part of it. Do you have any thoughts about effective ways to do that?
Probably none that you don't already have, but let me say a couple of words. Piety, as classically understood, comprises but is not limited to, for example, devotional acts, the corporeal works of mercy. It comprises those but isn't limited to them. It's also a properly intellectual set of acts. That's to say, acts that involve, on the one hand, submission to a particular tradition of reasoning. I choose the verb to submit with care. And on the other hand, an attempt to work out one's own intellectual life in constant response to that tradition. What the tradition looks like, of course, will differ from Catholic to Protestant and Orthodox, but we needn't worry about that. So I think that within the university, which I take to be the place of thought, that's its characteristic if it has one, it's the place where we're supposed to be thinking. Within the university, the aspect of piety that we ought to be encouraging is the intellectual aspect. The act of, that's to say, becoming aware of, and for those already to some extent submitted, more fully submitted to a particular tradition of reasoning and having their intellectual life given shape and form by that. The other aspects of piety, I think, are the task of other parts of the church. I and you are parts of the church, but I work in a university. I don't, for example, engage in the preparation of people for baptism or Mr. Goji leading people further into that's a task for those other parts of the church, fundamentally important. But thank God I don't have to do everything. So where that comes together sometimes, of course, is on a one-to-one basis where you've been teaching a class and student A or B wants to come and talk about this or that, and it turns out that student A or B is either the kind of Catholic who got baptized but hasn't been to church since, or somebody who's considering some kind of commitment to some religion, rather they have no idea what, or whatever it might be. And those conversations occur in a different way, I think. But that's an interpersonal thing, I think. Yeah.
And I was reminded by your talk of the figure in Pilgrim's Regress by C.S. Lewis of reason on a woman on a horse who said, "I cannot tell you what premises to start with," or something to that effect. "I can only show you the errors in your thinking from those."
Right. Right.
Is there a place for that in the art? I mean,
yeah.
Is that a starting point to at least stir the longing for piety? Or?
Right, it can be. I think it can be. It will depend, I think, on local diagnosis. You've got to figure out who you're talking to, what the setting is. In some settings, for example, large public settings, well, let's say you've got an address and a response and then maybe a roundtable discussion, and you know that the audience is deeply pluralist, you know that there's everything, then certain kinds of things are possible, other things aren't. One of the things that may be possible is to try to point to the inner logic or form of a position that's been defended that you don't agree with, and to try and show what internally is problematic about that. Certainly that's a relevant thing. But what I'm resisting, I suppose, is the idea that there'll be a single set of rules about how to do it. It will depend entirely, I think, on diagnosis of the particular local situation. And it may look very different in different situations. In general, if there is a general thing to say, the most effective device, I think, is to present with all the richness and complexity that one has at one's command what our intellectual tradition has to offer. Because it's everything, really. The entire history of the West, intellectually speaking, is Christian and also Jewish, but dominantly Christian. We have to offer that. We have to know it. We have to present it. And we don't always have to defend it. Sometimes we just have to say, here it is. Here's how it goes. That often has better effects than the strictly argumentative, I think. But it will always be a local matter. Thanks.
Yeah. I was struck near the end of your talk by your initial observation that you find that your colleagues in many of your institutions are not so much unable to use reason, but the reason of the kind you're describing isn't as persuasive as some might think it to be. And then you laid out the point one and two. Could we not argue that particularly with the latter disordered love, that it might be to the extent that reason itself is thoroughly disordered? I guess I'm sort of raising the question about your initial assertion, your in fact encounter rationality in your colleagues.
Well, I didn't quite say I encounter rationality. I said that I encounter what its proponents take to be rationality. My point really was that, and I'm reacting here perhaps to something that's more specifically Catholic. There's been a recent Catholic tradition from the highest levels, the Pope, I mean, of identifying the principal intellectual problem that we in the West face as being some variety of relativism, or that's to say a despising of reason. I simply think that's not right. I simply don't meet that. You meet it among, you know, freshmen and things, but that's another whole story. What I meet among my colleagues is not a despising of reason. It's a passionate deployment of reason in the service of goals that often to me seem either incoherent or even sometimes damnable. But nonetheless, they're not relativists. They think this is all true. And they'd like to convince other people of it too, just like I do, right? So that's what I'm objecting to. Now, it may well be that their uses of reason are screwed up in one way or another. And that, I think, is to do with the nature of their loves. But from their point of view, it seems to them like they're being reasonable, I would say.
I would want to affirm that latter statement, but I have one curiosity. It's maybe more of a puzzle, maybe we don't know. Why is it that they seem so widely unaware of the very fact that they are employing rationality, even oftentimes in the interest of destroying it?
Well, I think mostly they're not unaware of it. I mean, help me out here. You guys are, you know, in universities, right? Either as students or teachers or both. When I go to, you know, a faculty seminar on X, I just don't hear people trashing reason. I just don't. I hear people attempting to use it with a set of commitments that may cause self-destruction of the enterprise. But nonetheless, that's what I hear. So I don't think people are unaware of the fact that they're using rationality. They think they are using it. They want to argue and persuade just as I do. But maybe we have a different sense of how the university works. I mean, gender studies, the example I took, the good theorists in that tradition, and there are some very challenging ones, have a strong view both of the nature of what it means to be gendered and of the significance of that for understanding intellectual history, social history, institutional history, and so on. This is not an unreasonable, it may be wrong, but it's not unreasonable, right? It deserves to be taken seriously as a complex position. And most of it's like that, I think. Yeah.
This type of reason that you say that many of your colleagues are optimistic about what you're pessimistic, this may be something that's behind your talk and you're just not saying, I don't know. That seems to be a modern view of reason as a disembodied method that once it is honed and disciplined through correct epistemology and logic, is something that we can use to affirm the correspondence, what's in our head with reality. Mm. That seems, and your reservations about it seem to be precisely the things that are addressed by a classical use of reason by people like Aristotle, Augustine. And for example, a distinction is that in the modern use of reason, reason is set over against, you know, Cartesian reason is set over against rhetoric. Whereas in classical reason, as you know from your Augustinian studies, rhetoric is a type of reason. And it's something rational rhetoric, what it does is it starts with public opinion, which I wonder if that could be the same thing as what you're calling catechism. It starts with the public opinion, and then the role of rhetorical reason is to make distinctions within the public opinion that's accepted by who you're talking to that better bring reality to presence for your listeners. And that classical use of reason is not a use of reason that is disembodied and will get a lot of agreement to your propositions really quickly. Rather, that use of reason is more of a political use of reason that I think that what began in early modern times. So isn't the classical use of reason really what you're searching for, and actually what separates you from your colleagues at these other gender studies, African-American studies, that are more a result of the kind of the hyper-rationalist, groundless use of reason that post-structuralism has ended up in?
Yeah. There's a lot there. I think I mostly disagree, but I may not quite got you right. Let's start with the classical end. As I'm sure you know, to take the example of Augustine, who was trained as a rhetor, a practitioner of the rhetorical arts, spends most of his first 10 years after baptism polemicizing against the training that he received and explaining what's wrong with it. He thought, and who am I to criticize him on this, he'd had the training I haven't. He thought that the training was precisely a training in technique separated from truth. It was a training aimed at persuasion at all costs without interest in truth. And he quotes all the usual examples, you know, that you, in order to be good, you have to be able to compose speeches on anything, whether you believe it or not, and they have to have the same structure and so on and so forth. So if we go back behind Augustine and look at, for example, the early Platonic dialogues, the Socrates of the early dialogues, or we look at somebody like Sextus Empiricus, I think we can see there a purely dialectical use of reason that is probably not what you mean by classical reason, but there it is in the classical period. So part of the point of that is that I don't really buy this it all went wrong with Descartes thing. I think it's always been wrong, it's always been screwed up, that all of the options are always out there. That was true in pre-Christian times, it was true in late antiquity, it was true in the high medieval period. Duns Scotus, for example, well, this will get me into trouble, but Duns Scotus, I think, is completely screwed up. He just doesn't understand Christianity even, right? And yet there he is a very, very important figure in 14th century Europe and so on. So the reason he doesn't is because well, we won't go into that. But I don't like to do it chronologically. That's one point. Another point is that I think the disembodied Cartesian universalistic mathesis universalis view of reason is what I would say belongs to the older model of the departmental wissenschaftliche university. That's what that's all about. Max Weber is the great theorist of this, right? If you read Max Weber's great little essay, what's it called? Wissenschaft als Beruf, right? Science as a vocation, right? Science means scholarship. It doesn't mean, you know, physics. He lays all this out perfectly. This is the hyper-Cartesian view. It's the view that informs the idea of the discipline. It's the view that informs the idea of the department. That, I think, is effectively gone. So that these tradition-specific programs that I'm talking about and the decay of the department that I talked about marks the end of that. What we've got in gender studies, African-American studies, whiteness studies, and also Catholic studies is something quite different. We've got something more like what you're calling classical rhetoric, a tradition-specific understanding of and stance toward the intellectual life and a local set of arguments. I think that's what we've got. Universal aspirations, of course, but self-conscious about its particularity. That's, for example, Foucault versus Descartes. And Foucault's right about this, in my view, but that might be arguable. So, you know, but there's a hugely complicated historical issue there. I'm not really competent to sort them all out. But thanks, that's a very helpful question.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I'm going to use an example that comes from James Turner in his book, The History of Unbelief. It seems to me that what you're touching on with your distinction of optimistic pessimists, optimists about truth and pessimists about truth, we might use the word pessimists that are humility.
Yeah.
But the case that he described Christians in America began to lose faith in the 1800s, when they changed their view about criminal punishment. When criminal punishment began to be humanized, when people's hands were cut off, when providers mischief, people were put in stocks, suddenly people's views of God the judge began to be humanized, and they began to wonder, well, if we can forgive, then maybe our picture of God the judge has gone wrong. So the point of raising this as an example is only to say is the problem of redeeming reason, a problem of an ongoing task that never ends, in the sense that we, except for, say, a menu, a particular machine, we never quite get it when we're trying to develop a philosophy of justice or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the last bit. I'd have to see the Hunter example worked out, I guess. I mean, I can see the logic of it, but the particulars of it seem to me so odd that I don't quite know what to say. I mean, anyone who thinks that God is a judge in an unnuanced sense of that word, without an analogical theory of language and an understanding of what it means for participation to occur, is already sub-Christian, I think. And the idea that if we stop cutting people's hands off, we're going to lose our faith in God seems to me one I'd have to think about more. But the last part, I certainly agree. That's what I meant by saying this is an eschatological task. You know, it's not one that we ever get to. So that certainly seems right. Interesting, yeah.
Your comments about reason to university are so really at odds with our speaker this morning, Graham Walker. So I'm just trying to make sense of these two very radically different perspectives. And I wonder if one way to make sense of this is that as individuals, professors generally engage in activity that they take to be very rational and involved with the use of reason. But that the larger impact of these always multiple tradition specific studies in the university, in the atmosphere, the ambiance of the university, the general intellectual climate, is to sort of, in effect, cause the subjugation of reason to some greater principle of tolerance and diversity. Because we clearly, most of us, I think, that's the mantra we hear, tolerance, diversity, pluralism. So I wonder if those two things might be happening at once. The individuals are acting in reason, but the effect is quite different.
Well, this is a good thing, right?
Well, to the degree that we can get into that atmosphere, it seems to me it's a good thing. But on the other hand, the degree to which that effect of that might be to, in students' lives especially, decrease the capacity for or the willingness to engage in the use of reason, it seems to me that might be very negative.
Well, it depends what you think the other option is, right? I mean, the other option, as I tried to sketch it in the talk, was... The other option, as I tried to sketch it in the talk, was that we try to identify a particular point in the past at which it was all okay, when everyone believed that reason was a good thing and that reason would yield truth and that there was a harmoniously shared set of convictions about that in institutions of higher education. Now, in my view, even to begin to think like that is already to be in the grip of a profound theological error. It's to look for, in the state of things here below, something that one should not expect to find, and the act of looking for it will be exactly the error that Augustine identifies in Book One of The City of God. And the error there is to identify the Roman polity with a structure that is essential for the flourishing of Christianity. This is idolatry. And I suspect the same thing may be in play here. Instead, better would be to look at every particular period in the now long human history of thinking and look at those periods with the following goal. What is screwed up here is the thing to ask. And there'll always be a whole lot. The thing not to do is to look for a time when it was okay. that time occurred, not even really then, but briefly before the fall, and we don't have access to that. So I don't think the other option is better. The other option, if it's a 1950s style pre-post-structuralist confidence in the Weberian Wissenschaftliche Research University, I don't want that, absolutely not. That's anti-Christian, that's worse, much worse, right? So I think what we've got now is bad in different ways, but not in that way. And so that may be a difference in the questions one wants to ask, right? Yeah. Yeah.
I like your idea of having the many studies and people in conversation with African American studies and gender studies and Catholic studies being in there and being able to converse with one another. But my question happens when, how do we define what is our tradition as Christians? Because I think that we have this tradition that we've almost falsely constructed, talking about, you know, Christian scholars, Catholic scholars, but then there's also this other tradition of Christians who were missionaries who had all these issues with whiteness, and they're African-American Christians who are not really put into this Catholic studies because they weren't famous. And then I ask, how do we talk about, how do we define the limits of Catholic studies or Christian studies?
Right. That's a great question, to which I think there is no clear answer. That's a constant negotiation, trying to figure out what the boundaries of a tradition are, what's in and what's out, what it's best to advert to and what it's best not to. No decision about that will be finally satisfactory. You're certainly right that a great deal is always excluded, and some of it for bad reasons. I think that's quite right. I don't have then a set of heuristic principles that's going to tell you what to include and what not. I think that also will be to some extent local. For example, I'm teaching a class of 60, mostly freshmen, an introduction to Catholic thought this semester. And these students are about two-thirds Catholic and one-third not, and of the one-third not, mostly not Christian, mostly Muslim, in fact. And of the Catholic lot, they're pretty evenly divided between Catholics with roots in Mesoamerica or South America on the one hand, and Catholics with roots in Eastern Europe on the other hand. And many of these are very recent roots. That's to say their parents are the immigrants, or they weren't born here either, right? Now, in such a setting, I make some choices about what of the Catholic intellectual tradition to present in response to who I've got there. Because there's a whole lot I could present, I'm always going to have to make some choices about what to present. So I try to judiciously mix what I take to be centrally important normative expositions of key concepts on the one hand, and local representations on the other hand. But what those local representations are, I think, would vary if I had a different lot of people in front of me. So it's all going to be local negotiable, I think. Does that sound right? Yeah, okay. Okay. Should I take someone who hasn't yet? Yeah.
I'm curious what it looks like in sort of engaging with an interlocutor, perhaps not a student, but in the university, fellow faculty member, for example, and sort of you have a good argument going, and then you recognize, well, argument's not where the persuasion is going to be at,
right.
at this point. Right. There needs to be catechesis here, or maybe right. Some kind of sort of prod toward piety.
Right.
I mean, how does that play out for an in an environment of intellectual debate?
Yeah, well, I can tell you what I try always to do, and many of my colleagues are not only smarter than I am, but sufficiently good-spirited to also want to do it. It's surely common, without respect to whether it's a debate between Christians and non-Christians, it's surely common to come to a point where one becomes aware that there are more or less axiomatic commitments in play here that at this point arguments are not going to be helpful with. What argument can then do sometimes is, to the satisfaction of both participants, identify what those axiomatic commitments are, right? So, for example, I mean, even that won't always be doable, but sometimes it is. So, for example, I first had this brought home to me by listening to economists argue with one another. And they agree about nothing, as far as I can tell. But the reason they don't is because at some point in the debate, they'll stop arguing about the interpretation of this body of statistics and whatever, and they'll get down to something much more fundamental about an understanding of what a market is or the constraints that ought or ought not to be in play and so on and so on. And then the more good-spirited among them will acknowledge, okay, well, there's no point arguing about that, we're clear that, that our differences in interpretive stance with respect to the data in part flow from that. So that's what I try to do. So that if, for example, it turns out, just to take a completely non-controversial example, if it turns out that a colleague of mine wishes to advocate the continued fairly unrestricted availability of abortion in this country on the ground that there's a right to privacy enshrined in the 14th Amendment of the US Constitution and that it would be offensive and discriminatory to women to permit the law to have anything to say about this matter. And I, on the other hand, want to argue that the idea that there could be human persons who are not legal citizens is incoherent with respect to the Constitution, let's say. We can at least identify where the disagreement occurs. We won't be able to go any further than that. We can say, okay, this and this, and, you know, so it is. But that's something. I may go home and think about it more, and he may go home and think about it more. So that's the strategy I tend to adopt. Sometimes you can't even do that, because when, you know, the lust for victory kicks in, which it does in arguments all the time, then this gets harder to do. But and I'm more subject to that than most, so I, you know, mea culpa and all that. But you see what I mean? So I don't expect resolution, but you can sometimes have clear identification of here's where the difference really is.